This is an interview with Russell Snyder, who will be speaking with me, Barry York, for the Oral History Program of the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. Russell Snyder worked in the Old Parliament House Press Gallery 1968 through to 1983. On behalf of the director of the museum, I do want to thank you for being part of this. And do you understand that the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure is subject to anything you restrict on that rights agreement?
Yes, I do.
Thanks for that. And can we have permission to make a transcript or a summary if we are able to make one?
Yes, by all means.
Thank you again. The interview is taking place today, 14th of April 2015, at the museum here in Canberra. And can we begin just with a bit of personal background, like date and place of your birth?
Yeah, I was born in Sydney on the 16th of April 1946, almost 69 years ago today,
right.
Almost. My family lived in Newtown. My grandfather, Frank Connor, was the Secretary of the Liquor Trades Union at that time. He joined the army in World War One, signed up as a driver, which I always thought was pretty irrelevant. But actually, when you think about it, to have been a driver in those days, you probably had to be a pretty smart cookie, because you had to be a mechanic and everything, and the sort of vehicles they were driving in World War One were different from today. But anyway, after the war, he and a mate of his, Tom Watson, got a job washing bottles at Tooth's Brewery, and gradually worked their way up, and my grandfather became member of the union movement, became Secretary of the Liquor Trades Union. Tom Watson became the General Manager of Tooth's Brewery. And these days, I suppose, IPAC or something like that would be after the birth, because every Christmas Tom would send out to our house a couple of cartons of all of Tooth's products, ranging from beer through to champagne. So I think if it was good enough to take out a premier, it was probably good enough to have taken out both Tom and my grandfather. But anyway, we lived in Newtown. Newtown in those days was quite different from the Newtown of today. It was basically one of the slum cities, slum suburbs of Sydney, and a pretty rough place. If you took a cricket bat to school, it wasn't to play cricket, it was to beat off the other kids who were like beat up on you in the way through. And I went to Enmore Boys High School, where I was probably not the best of students until fourth year, when I got a very inspiring English teacher, a guy called Evan Sutton. Evan Casey Sutton was his name. And he got me very, very interested in literature, English and writing. And as a result of that, I decided that I probably would embark on a career as a writer if I could. And I got myself a job as a copy boy with the Old Sydney Daily Telegraph, which was then owned by Sir Frank Packer. My first real reporting assignment was in the sports department. And I was not particularly interested in sport, but it was the only place that I could get a job with the Telegraph, so I stayed there. I learned the trade by running copy for the sports of the rugby league writer, George Crawford, who would write out the story at a football match on sheets of paper, which I'd then run over to a telephone and phone in to a copy taker in the Telegraph building. Then after a while I got a cadetship, in those days it was a cadet had to achieve a certain standard, the shorthand, a minimum 60 words a minute. I managed the Telegraph brought in a lady called Kay Kersop, who was nothing to do with journalism but a great shorthand teacher, and with her tutelage I ended up getting up to Hansard speed, about 180 words a minute, as a result of which I was then given the job of court reporter, or a court reporter for the Telegraph. And Then went down to New South Wales Parliament House, where again became more interested in politics, and finally in 1967 there was a newspaper strike, and being from a good Labor trade union family, I took a fairly leading role in the strike and went on the State of Night, berated the Daily Telegraph and Sir Frank Packer and all concerned with it. Now, the strike lasted for 2 weeks. The union lost control of the strike. It was only intended to be for 1 or 2 days, but all the journos got Russian blood to the head, as they tend to do every 20 years or so, and said, we're going to stay out until we win. Well, we didn't win. As Frank Packer said in the editorial, we came back to work with our tail between our legs, and we did. And I realised that at that time I discovered that the money I'd lost in that 2 week strike, I was just never, ever going to be able to recoup, no matter how hard or how long I worked, because that money was gone forever. So that formed a sort of a different view about industrial relations in my mind. Anyway, after the strike was over, David McNichol, who was the editor-in-chief of the Telly, called me into his office and said, Alan Reid, who was the chief political correspondent for the Telegraph, the old Red Fox as he was known, would like you to go down to Canberra. And I said, well, what if I don't want to go to Canberra? And he said, well, there's nothing here for you. So it was fairly obvious that I either went to Canberra or had no future with the Telegraph in Sydney, so I came down to Canberra. Canberra at that stage, or Parliament House...
Rather, Russell, sorry to interrupt it, but at this point, before we talk about actually coming to Canberra, can I go back a bit and ask you to flesh out a few points? You mentioned your grandfather. What about your parents? What did they do for a living? What were their names?
My father, Jack, was his father was an engine driver. My father was a carpenter by trade, and he became a vehicle builder with the New South Wales Railways. And he stayed there till he retired. His father was an engine driver, and he was killed in a very unfortunate shunting accident at Rosehill, where he got caught between two carriages, and that was that. And my father grew up in the Depression, and he had a very, very hard life during that time. He didn't go to World War II, he went to the Snowy Mountains. He was one of the original people in the Snowy Mountains scheme. He was regarded as an essential worker, and got a job down there building the first part of the Snowy. I mean, it was obviously after World War II became a real project, but he was building the original huts and things like that.
Was he on Susso at that time, or was that a sustenance thing with the...
It was the Civil Construction Corps, which was sort of the civil conscription arm of the the government. And my mother was a seamstress, and she spent most of her time behind a sewing machine. Even when I was growing up, she had a back room in the house that we lived in. We lived in the same house with my grandparents. And she had a room at the back where she had a sewing machine set up, and she used to make swimming costumes for a woman called Kay Hilvert. And it was quite interesting. I used to help her assemble the costumes, and the same costumes were made with various different labels. Uh-huh. So made by the same person, same material, same design, but some retailed in the bargain basement and some were in exclusive boutiques. All the same people. So that was that.
And how long did you live in Newtown with your parents?
Oh, I lived in there till I came to Canberra when I was in 67, so I was 21. 20. So I stayed at home till I was 21.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
No. I had no. I had a cousin with whom I was very close, Barry, no brothers or sisters, and basically it was just a play. I was an only child, and my playmates were just the local kids. And in those days, it was funny. Newtown in those days was nothing like it is today. Not only was it sort of one of the slum places, but it's hard to believe if you go through it today to remember what it was like in the days when the streets just were a strip of tar in the middle of the road, and then with a grass verge on either side. Not at all like inner city is, but all the houses were two-storied tenements. And it was basically workers' cottages, I suppose. Just up the road we had the pick-me-up tomato sauce factory, and every now and then a tomato truck would come along and drop its load by accident, and the stench of rotten tomatoes would hang about for days. Yeah,
well, I can relate to what you're saying, because I had my first 30 years in Brunswick in Melbourne.
Same sort of place.
Very similar. Yeah. We're next door to a factory, and it's very different today, as with Newtown. It's got the demographics.
Yeah, totally changed.
And the desirability of the place. Everyone now wants to live there rather than wants to avoid it.
Well, that's right. In the days when I was young, you wanted to get out of Newtown, you didn't want to stay there, and you certainly didn't want to go there.
You mentioned your formal education, and sounds like you were very fortunate to have an excellent teacher of English literature. You said that made you interested in writing. Was that writing as in journalism or in a broader way?
Oh, yeah, I guess it was in a broader way. I mean, like everyone, every writer thinks that they're going to write the great novel, which I never got around to doing. I thought about a number of different things. I tried to get a job as an advertising copywriter. That didn't turn into anything. And I left school. I was young for my age when I left school. I was about 16, 8 months. And the first job I got actually was with the post office, a Christmas job, helping sort and carry mail. I came to acquire quite a respect for the poor old postie who had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to sort his letters out and actually working out how to do them to get the maximum efficiency on the route was really, really quite a challenge. But then after that, I waited about 4 weeks and was starting to feel fairly desperate, because in those days, and in my family, the thought of going on the dole was just, you didn't do it. In those days, you worked, you found a job. It didn't matter whether you liked the job or not. You just had to go and find something. So I was totally uncertain what I'd do. And I applied for a job with the Daily Telegraph as a copy boy and with the Fairfaxes. The Daily Telegraph called me in. The personnel officer in those days was a guy called Leo Basser. He was willing to give me a try, and so he put me on as a copy boy.
Was this an advertised job, like you came across it through reading?
No, I think from memory, I just wrote to the various newspapers, because there was the Daily Mirror, the Daily Telegraph, Sydney Morning Herald in Sydney, so each owned by a different group. So I just applied to each of them and took the first one I got. In fact, I don't think the Fairfax has even acknowledged my application.
But, when you look back on your childhood, how do you feel about it?
Oh, well, I wouldn't say it was unhappy. I wouldn't say it was spectacularly happy. It was sort of a period of my life that I had to go through, and it was enjoyable at times, but mostly it was probably endured rather than enjoyed.
And what was the source of that?
Oh, nothing in particular. It was just it's a modest, I suppose. I was young for my age. That's a bit silly. I was younger than the other kids in my class, so they were all a bit ahead of me. But I guess I may have been brighter than they were too. I ended up being selected to go to opportunity class at Erskineville, which in those days was where they picked the best and brightest from all the schools in the southwest. And I spent, I'd originally gone to Camdenville Primary School, and I was happy there, and then I found I had to go to this other school, which I wasn't all that pleased about. However, the idea of those schools was that they'd take the children who were I guess better able to move faster through the courses, and I did that, but it meant leaving all the former friends I had at the other school, and then went to Enwell Boys High 2 years later. That was okay. To a certain extent, I guess one of the problems was that being an only child and younger than the peer group, I tended to get pushed around a fair bit and bullied quite a lot. Almost every day coming home from school, there were a couple of other kids who'd beat me up, that wasn't enjoyable. And funnily enough, one of them came to Erskineville as well. So I couldn't escape that in either case. And then he came on to Enmore Boys High School. And funnily enough, by the time we got to fifth year, we actually ended up becoming quite good friends. But I guess that was probably the main thing I wasn't all that keen on in my childhood. There were a couple of funny memories you have. Coming back to my grandfather, I used to enjoy going into his... He had an office in the old trades hall in Golden Street, I think it was. And it had an old... one of those old fashioned lifts, which they used to have here, in fact, where, with the two doors that you had to open up, concertina sort of thing. And one day I was in there playing with the typewriter, which his secretary used to let me do, and a couple of guys came in, and there was an altercation between them, and he ended up throwing two of them down the stairs. And I don't know what his politics were. He must have been at the time, the industrial groups in the ALP, because I remember it being said that he'd thrown two communist union officials down the stairs, so he was probably in the right-wing industrial groups, which is probably, as I think about it now, it's probably fairly true, because one of my early contact stroke mentors in the newspaper business was Laurie Short of the Federated Ironworkers, and he remembered my grandfather, so because of that association he was willing to spend a lot of time talking to me about union matters, because apart from anything else I'd done, as well as reporting Parliament and courts, I was also the assistant industrial roundsman with Jack Simpson, who was the industrial reporter for the Daily Telegraph. So when Jack was on holidays or having a day off or anything like that, I'd do the industrial round, and got to know quite a few of the union officials that way. But Laurie was always the one I felt most confident with. So,
were your parents political?
Not terribly, not over much. My father was a shop steward, he wouldn't call himself that. He was the union rep in the at Roselle, or one of the union reps at Roselle, but not terribly political as such. Certainly not in they were very good Labour. It was a Labour family, there's no doubt about that.
Because I guess Newtown generally would have been Labour, but
very, very much so. And our local member was Fred Daly. And Fred and I actually became quite close in later years when I was working here in Parliament House. Fred had come around every Friday. I was columnist. I had to write a column for the Weekend Australian, and it had to be done by 1 o'clock at the latest, which was okay because you'd finish it by one and go to lunch and finish off that that was the end of the Friday, basically.
Okay.
But I'd be in the office around about 10 a.m. and Fred would wander through the gallery. He'd retired from Parliament in those days and he was running his Canberra bus tours.
Oh.
And he'd come into the gallery on Friday morning and he'd pop his head round into my office and he'd start telling jokes. And he was a great, great teller of jokes. And of course, the old bugger, he knew that he was holding me up. He knew that I had to get this column done by 1 o'clock, and or by 12 o'clock. And nevertheless, he wouldn't leave until he'd exhausted himself of all these stories, and finally he'd go and I'd then have to work my guts out to get it done in time. But he'd been my local member.
What about your mother? Was she she would have been a Labor person too?
Yeah, but not fanatically so. I mean, they never joined the party as such. My father might have been a member of, I don't think he was even a member of the party actually. My grandfather did want him to get more involved than he was, but that didn't suit him. He was fairly happy just doing what he was doing.
What about religion? Was religion a factor?
It was house? Good. My grandparents were Connor and Morgan. My grandfather was Frank Connor and my grandmother was Elsie Morgan. So it was sort of the orange and the green. Overall, it was a good Catholic, Roman Catholic family, and the nuns would come around every Sunday morning to make sure I went to church at St. Pius Church down in Edgware Road. So I'd go and go to Mass. My parents and grandparents stayed home. they made sure that I was on the pathway to heaven. So I guess like all the other kids in the group, I attended church as a matter of necessity rather than desire. So I wouldn't say I was probably a failed Catholic more than anything else.
And what about the standard of living that you had at the time?
Well, funnily enough, it didn't seem all that bad. I mean, I wasn't used to anything better. And I guess when you're a kid, so long as you aren't hungry, you're happy. I think overall, a standard of living was... we weren't a wealthy family by any means, but there was always food in the house, and the house itself was certainly no mansion, but it was comfortable. The roof didn't leak, and there was carpet on the floor. And although as I think back on it, the modern conveniences were non-existent. I think we had an ice chest. We had a guy come down with a horse-drawn carriage, literally, with blocks of ice. And he'd run through the house with a big block of ice held in a pick. And go into the laundry area where the refrigerator was, or not the refrigerator, the chiller. And open the top of it, put the ice in there, close it up, go back out to his horse, and then go down to the next place.
Yeah.
And up the road from us, this in Newtown, was a dairy, believe it or not. And I used to go up there in the, every day and pick up a pail, and take it up there, and the woman would pour the milk out from the big canisters. Into this pail, and I'd walk back home with the day's milk. So this was probably about 1950, 52, 53.
Did you have the rabbitos coming round?
No, it was... there were certainly guys, fruit and vegetable trucks. We had sewerage. They put the sewer through, although most of the houses had outhouses. And behind most houses, there was those tiny little lanes that were just wide enough for the guys to go through and collect the night soil. But by the time I was born, but certainly from the time I can remember, we had the sewer on, no hot water. Hot water was a kerosene fueled thing that was like a jet engine and roared away, and there were chip heaters that some people had, but we were pretty upmarket. We had a Kero heater.
Outside of your formal education and being at home, what were your interests in your younger years? Were you like bookish type of young fellow?
I read a lot. Yeah, I did. I read a lot when I was very young. When I was five, six maybe. I remember my grandfather was reading Sears Forrester's Hornblower series, and I picked it up and I read the whole. I went through the whole series by myself. So my mother must have read to me quite a lot as a child. Well, I don't remember that. But I was able to read very early on, and I guess I was fairly bookish. Wasn't much good at maths. I fancied myself becoming a chemist, actually, at one stage, but neither my maths nor my chemistry were up to it. But I guess I was probably an introverted kid, I guess. And I had to fight my way out of that introversion into. You couldn't survive in this place if you're an introvert. You had to, particularly in the gallery, you just had to get out of your shell and speak up and ask questions and be known and noticed.
When you were younger, would you read political stuff at all, like political history, or follow politics at all?
Not terribly much. Although, because of my grandfather, I mixed in a lot more with political activities, although most of it was way above my head. But I remember, I vividly remember on one occasion going to a function, which was either a Labor Party one or a trade union one, and my grandfather introduced me to Doc Evatt, who was then the leader of the Labor Party, and I sat on Doc Evatt's knee, and which I remember, and I didn't know who the hell Doc Evatt was, as far as I wasn't sure whether he was going to jab me with a needle or give me a prescription, but he seemed a nice enough old fella, and but I certainly wasn't involved in school politics or anything like that. I didn't go to university straight after school. I got a teacher's college scholarship. And in fact, I guess when I got the copy boy job, my choice was to either take that or go into teacher's college. And I just didn't fancy being a teacher. And I didn't really fancy going to... I'd had enough of school at that stage, so I got first class honours in English and an A in French, so it was sort of obviously going to be a rival, well, some sort of direction. My direction was going down that pathway, what was I going to say? Oh, it'll come back to me, doesn't it? But I certainly wasn't. Oh, that's right. A couple of years later, when I was down here, I decided that I would like to get a degree, so I went to enrolled in the ANU as a part-time art student, majoring in pulse science and economics. Professor Finn Crisp was the head of the School of Political Science over at the ANU. he was very, very keen to get people who actually were in, if not in the political system, at least working within the political environment. And so he became quite a mentor. The first, was it the first year or the second year? I think it might have been the second year. Anyway, the exams in one year, it was the year of 1970. That was the year of a Senate election, my first Senate election that I'd gone to report, and the Senate election coincided with the university exams. So I had to do a deferred exam, and which was fortunate because Finn marked it himself. I think I would have failed if it had been anybody else, because I said there was something about some quote about political science, whether political science was a science or not. And I started my answer off saying, the problem is all political scientists live in academic Disneyland. And I thought, well, that's made sure I'm going to fail this course. But Crisp must have loved it, because I passed with distinction. And he made a point of coming out to me later and saying what a refreshing essay, well, not essay, refreshing answer it was. But the reason I said that was that I finally gave the course away. We just had a child, and that was taking up a lot of time. But I found after a while the tutors, I was providing more to the class than the tutors were. And one of the things that annoyed me was that even though the ANU was just across the lake, you never saw any of the PolSci tutors or lecturers in this building. Just never came here. And it always disappointed me that, that may have changed, it probably has changed now, but it was, to my mind, this was the greatest laboratory that they could have had. And
weren't far away from it.
No, it's not as though it was a long distance trip. So, I guess when you say was I political at all, when I got into, when I started work, I did involve myself in trade union activities, or actually the Australian Journalist Association never regarded itself as a trade union. It was it was way above that. And as I said, when the strike was on in 67, I was fairly heavily in. I was one of the young Turk enthusiasts who were saying stay out forever. And then when we came down here, I went on to the District Committee of the AJA and stayed on that for a couple of years. That was about the deepest in my quote political involvement was. That's not true. I had tried to join the Labor Party when I was in Sydney, but the amount of rigmarole that went through it, obviously it was not much different in those days in terms of things like branch stacking and things like that, so that if you weren't known and approved of, they didn't want you in the branch. And so I found the what to me seemed to be a very, very tedious arrangement was just too much trouble, so I sort of thought no. And but I voted Labor in the first couple of elections. I guess one of them was I was 20 in 1966 when Harold Holt won that incredible victory. But I voted for Arthur Cornwell mainly because he was opposed to conscription. I wasn't really enthusiastic about the idea either.
I was going to ask about that, like that period in the late 60s when the strike was on and you came to Canberra.
Mm.
And there was a lot happening with a lot of unrest, people in your age back then.
Well, funnily enough, I was never anti-Vietnam, And I wasn't even strongly anti-conscription, so long as it didn't involve me. But if I'd been, if I had been conscripted, I would have gone, and I wouldn't have been a conscientious objector or anything like that. I just would have found it an inconvenience. Actually, was my attitude really. It didn't take long. I actually concluded after a fairly short time, particularly as I wasn't going to get shot, that the war actually was probably fairly justified. That was the view that I formed. I did have to, in Sydney, there were a lot of anti-Vietnam marches going on, of course, and you had to report those. And I think that's one of the things that probably turned me off. The vehemence and the violence that the anti-conscription people did, I just found a little bit over the top. I mean, it was one thing to protest, but the violence that it engendered didn't appeal to me. And I thought, well, if that's the sort of way people are going to behave, I'm not so sure I want to be part of that. So that was, I suppose that was the beginning of the turning point where I shifted from the left to, I suppose, I'm not sure whether I'd say the right or the moderate centre.